This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 30th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Alan John. Coming up on the show, we speak to those for and against the reconstruction of the Berlin City Palace.
By building, for example, this palace, the center of Berlin is becoming more and more a tourist place and not a place for people who actually live here and want to do something in the city.
We head into the future to meet the minds behind the Industrial Revolution exhibition at London's Design Museum.
We're now on the edge of something which could have equally profound consequences. The idea that you don't need to invest in a factory anymore, that you can actually make things at home. It's saying that the design process is going to be quite different, and people's relationships with their objects is also going to be completely different.
And Nicholas Roop, founder of design agency Poke, tells me how his company had a rather blank canvas for the revamping of British fashion brand Mulberry's new online estate.
When you think about the product, it's beautifully crafted and it's really, really simple and iconic, and it really has a respect for the user. So it's the same with the site. It seemed very obvious to us, which is, if you're taking that as a lead, what does that mean in the way that you would organise things digitally?
Plus, we find out if a new design for a workout at your work desk could catch on. We witness the revitalisation of France's Alpine telecabins, and we pay a trip to the sprawling music academy in Madrid's El Matadero district. That's all here on Section D with me, Alad John, on Monocle 24. For decades, the reconstruction of the Berlin City Palace, or Berliner Schloss, has been a highly controversial and publicised project. Originally built in the 15th century, it was a royal imperial palace in the centre of Berlin, at that time the historical capital of Prussia. Destroyed by Allied bombs during the Second World War, the ruling powers of communist East Germany erected their new state government building on the rubble in 1964. By 2011, after years of discussion and debate, the German federal government voted in favour of reconstructing the palace at an estimated cost of 590 million euros. The construction has been underway since June this year, dividing the German public into two opposing camps. Monocle's Melanie Sevchenko spoke to the people behind the project on both sides of the debate to understand what this resurrection of history means to the German capital.
Not far from the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Museum Island in Berlin's central district of Mitte, a massive cultural project is underway, stretching city blocks of dirt, dust, and heavy machinery. It's the reconstruction site of the Humboldt Forum in the Berliner Schloss, or the Berlin City Palace, a project that has sparked countless debates as an attempt to restore Berlin's historical center. The cultural minister of Berlin has called it a window on the cultures of the world, while its opposition has compared it to Disneyland. The project is being executed in cooperation with the Central and Regional Library of Berlin, Humboldt University, and the Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation, one of the largest cultural institutions in Germany, encompassing all the national museums, libraries, and archives in Berlin.
When the decision was taken to reconstruct the building, the palace, the point was, if we do this in the center of Berlin, not to use it as for looking at yourself, at German or Prussian culture. So we have opposite the German Historical Museum, for example. So it should be something, a place which is open to the world. And we have on the other side, we have the Museum Island, where there are these outstanding collections of antiquity until 19th century, Europe, the Near East. And then the question was what to bring in the Humboldt Forum.
Hermann Partzinger is the president of the Berlin Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation, which is responsible for the concept of the Humboldt Forum in the Berliner Schloss. This new building, however, will not house Prussian artifacts, but rather non-European art.
We have on the periphery of Berlin, in Dahlem, wonderful collections, really outstanding, of art and culture of Africa, America, Asia, Oceania, and to bring them into the center. And the funny thing is, they have been originally in the Berlin Palace.
Most of the art collections found in Berlin museums, in fact, originated from Brandenburg dukes and Prussian kings. They had been kept in the original royal palace before being moved to Museum Island.
What we want is Museum Ireland and Humboldt Forum as a unity, and to develop it really as a unique center of world culture. And therefore, we bring to the Humboldt Forum that what is still missing in the center, because all the buildings around are somehow mirroring this building, are related to it, and this core is missing. And I think the important thing is that inside there is something completely different, dedicated to the world, showing Berlin and Germany as an open country, open to the world. We have more and more people from other countries, from other continents here in Berlin. They should feel a home here.
The project is actually a part reconstruction. The Baroque facade will be a complete rendering of the original, while the other part, almost as big as the reconstruction itself, is in fact contemporary architecture, designed by Professor Franco Stella, who won the competition for the design of the new palace.
In European cities, the practice of reconstructing monuments has always existed. Particularly in the 20th century, there have been many cases of monuments destroyed by World Wars I and II, and by natural disasters that have subsequently been rebuilt. In Germany, for example, nearly all residential palaces have been destroyed and rebuilt. I also think that the buildings of the past represent the contemporary city. Should a European city free itself from its historical buildings and monuments to be contemporary, to look like Dubai or Shanghai? I think that history adds a cultural richness to today's city.
Peter Wohlwender is a student of architecture at the University of Arts Berlin. He's also a member of Schloss Freiheit, an organization that strongly opposes the reconstruction of the palace. For Wohlwender, it represents a distorted version of the contemporary capital.
Berlin is a really poor city compared to other cities in Germany. We are like cutting budgets for schools, for museums and so on. This is like one of the financial reasons, but for me, why Berlin is such an interesting city is because it's an authentic city and people enjoy the city because it has like these true layers of history, like the Berlin Wall, for example, the Kaiser Wilhelm Church, which is like a Second World War ruin added with a glass building, or for example, the new museum by Chipperfield, which all are like dealing with this problem of the destruction and being authentic. And for me, like the new palace would be a step against this whole movement and the whole idea of the city.
Germany allocates a large chunk of funding for its high culture, so it's easy to see how culture and politics mesh in colossal projects like the palace. Wohlwender says the institutes behind it have privileged connections to politics.
They started this campaign, and I would suggest that they have like a certain vision of history. In Germany, we call them like Neo-Prussians, which try to define the old proud to be German, proud to be Prussian, because they are talking a lot about identity, and I would say it's not the identity of my city or of Berlin, because Berlin is like has other identities and not the Prussian one.
Before construction began in June, the site had been used as a public space, a green pasture for sports and barbecue in a gap that provided a panoramic view of Mitte, encompassing historic relics like Unter den Linden and the Berliner Dome, alongside landmarks from communist times like Alexanderplatz and the TV Tower. These open spaces are exactly what Schloss Freiheit is fighting for.
People occupy it and they do whatever they want to do with it, and this would be a solution for this heart of the city, because by building, for example, this palace, the center of Berlin is becoming more and more a tourist place and not a place for people who actually live here and want to do something in the city.
The battle against the palace has been ongoing since its conception in the 15th century. Yet Wohlwender and Schloss Freiheit have brought their opposition to present day. They stepped away from over-intellectualizing the debate and performed actions in the open space before reconstruction began, in the hopes that they could put the brakes on the project.
We should stop with this ideology and leave this space open like for one generation and then decide like what we need in this town, what could define our city in 2000X.
But Stella argues that the palace must be reconstructed for its socio-political importance for the German nation, as well as for the urban identity of Berlin. The palace was not in Berlin, but Berlin was the palace, said the writer Joop Siedler, to point out that the Berlin Palace was born before the city and influenced its main places and monuments. Again, Franco Stella.
Tutte le piazze, monumenti del centro di Berlino.
All the public places and monuments of Berlin city referred to the palace, and now, in the urban scene that it defined, it is the only missing element. The City Palace was, and will be, the key figure to understanding the city centre of Berlin.
Scheduled for completion in 2018, the Berlin City Palace aims to be a magnet for the Berlin public and for visitors from around the world. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
You're listening to Section D. Lots more coming up, including Polk's revamping of Mulberry's online profile. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Alad John, here on Monocle 24. Now, when fashion company Mulberry considered revamping their online platform, they needed a design that could reflect their ascendancy from UK brand to luxury retailer. Capturing the luxury experience online is a tricky thing to achieve, but a challenge which Nicholas Roop and his team at Polk were keen to take on as they strive to create a user-centric so-called digital estate. Nicholas joined me in the studio to discuss the project.
When you start trying to figure out, like, you know, what do you do in the digital space? You know, obviously the first, you jump to conclusions like saying, okay, we need a site, we need a microsite, we need this, we need that. But actually everybody kind of tends to need their own mix. It's like when you walk into a tailor's and you're trying to choose something. I mean, you can have anything. You know, the skill of the tailor is establishing, you know, what it is you need and what you're going to feel really good in and what's going to make sense to your requirements. So it's a bit the same, really. It's, you know, it's trying to figure out what's the right mix and what do they really need. And also, of course, you know, how do you really exploit the things that they have? You know, the things that they stand for, the things, the strengths that they have. How do you build around that? How do you really turn that to an advantage?
And without simplifying it too much, what were those focuses for Mulberry for you?
Well, Mulberry, I think, you know, anybody who knows the brand will know what it stands for, which is really about quality and craft. So, you know, with a lot of luxury brands, it's sort of, it's relatively skin deep. So, you know, the story starts to sort of unravel a little bit as you buy the product and start using it. With Mulberry, it's kind of the reverse, which is, you know, they have, because they're crafted beautifully, they're really selective about the, you know, the materials. And they're also thinking really hard about use. So they're really sort of projecting forward and thinking, well, how, you know, not just how do we flog this thing, but also how do we make the use of this object really great, you know, resolve the utility side of it. Because of the nature of the product, it stands up to scrutiny. And obviously, the web and digital channels are perfect. Really, you know, image quality is immense now. And obviously, with so many kind of luxury customers using tablet and mobile, I mean, resolution isn't a problem anymore. So images can be beautiful and lush. And also, we can really take people into the details and really show people that there are so many kind of stories with these products. It's not just the beautifully kind of crafted frontal shot. You actually kind of take people on a journey into the product. And it felt like that was one of the great advantages Mulberry had, that you could get this much more intimate view. And of course, you know, as well as competing against other luxury brands, they're also competing against the aggregator retailers like, you know, Net-a-Porter and, you know, Etal and
ASOS and the like.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and really the opportunity that Mulberry have because of this strength is to be able to say, well, rather than just presenting a standard view of the product, which all the aggregators have to do because they need to sort of set a level playing field for their customers, let's ask ourselves, you know, what's specifically interesting and great about our product, and let's really go to town on that. So actually, you might be looking at the same item on different sites, but the Mulberry one will just be the best. It'll be the one that will give you the most trust in, you know, in what the product is really about. It'll give you the most detailed story. It will give you the best feel for the material.
That's an interesting idea, giving you a feel for the material through an online platform, effectively.
I mean, in every product shot, there's just a, you know, there's the best possible rendering of the material in, you know, at, you know, best approximation of life size, so you really get a sense of what the texture and the feel of that. It would be nice if we could actually magic up a little bit of texture for people to have a little feel of, but that's not possible.
We're not there yet.
Yet.
We talked some before we came on air about how it's not just a website. You mentioned it's a digital estate.
Yeah.
It's across both online and tablet. I mean, there's many different sort of facets to this project for you. What was the most challenging idea behind it?
I think the most challenging thing is dealing with the whole, really, because you know, it's very tempting. Like I said earlier, you know, it's tempting when you approach these kinds of projects to just start with, okay, we need to make a website. The truth is, you know, the way that people interact with brands and retailers and all these things, it's very multifaceted, it's very complex, very layered. And what's quite interesting is that homepages aren't the key entry points for most users on most sites these days. I mean, people come from so many different places through, you know, through search, through social, through recommendation, you know, off the back of a film, from an ad or whatever it might be. So it's not really about these kind of, it's a product of our psychology that we want to sort of think about these things as contained, you know, problems, as individual problems to solve. Truth is, it's actually, you need to think about it in terms of a whole estate, because actually wherever people are interacting with your stuff and your business is important and needs consideration.
Yeah.
And when you think about it as one big integrated ecosystem, then you can start to connect it together more meaningfully. When you think about it in silos, when you think about it as like the site's over here, the YouTube channel's over here, the Twitter's over here, we're doing some content, but it's not talking to any of those things over here. You know, you're also not leveraging the potential value of what you get when you start to move those channels, you know, move those audiences around between those channels and giving them exposure to, you know, to different things, different offers, always with the prospect of showing them something that might interest them, that might lead to a purchase, or just showing them something cool and interesting that they might want to share with their friends or whatever it might be. So, you know, when you get to look at it as a whole, it gets much more powerful. And the other thing, of course, when you're looking at just the .com itself, you know, it's not a single entity. That the same, I mean, it's one URL, but effectively there are three different sites being served from that. I mean, it's the same content, but if you access it on your mobile or on tablet, you get three completely different experiences that are really optimized to those platforms. So again, it's not one fixed entity. It's a very kind of dynamic.
Very multi-layered, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, approaching such a multi-layered project as a designer, obviously, it's quite a daunting experience. Did Mulberry give you blank canvas to just go, well, these are the core, our core values and what we need to get out of it? Obviously, it needs to be very user-centric and the consumer needs to be able to navigate their way through it and search it without, like you say, not disconnecting the composite parts. But was it a kind of, you have the funding, we trust you, go for it kind of thing?
Well, they were very open. I mean, I think there were probably 30 agencies in the running at some point and we managed to win the account. I think what, you know, the reason why they brought us in is just I think we intuitively got where they were as a brand and understood how that would translate into the digital world. And really, the answer is quite simple, really, which is when you think about the product, it's beautifully crafted and it's really, really simple and iconic. It's not too fussy. It's not too fancy, you know, and it really has a respect for the user in the sense that, you know, they try to think through things so they're more usable, more pleasurable to own and to use every day. So it's the same with the site. It seemed very obvious to us, which is, you know, if you taking that as a lead, what does that mean in a digital, but for the way that you would organize things digitally? And the answer is you just try and organize them and simplify them, make them really, really intuitive. You know, try and look at all aspects of the experience. This is another really, really key part to the project. Brands, particularly in the fashion luxury realm, because the visual, you know, because aesthetics has been such a driver of business and reputation, kind of the notion of brand for so long, it's very, very easy to get caught up in obsessing about that at the cost of the mechanics. Now, I think conveniently, because Mulberry have this sort of respect for craft and the actual use of their products, and that's been an important story for them, it was very easy to get them on board with the idea that, you know, of course it needs to be beautiful, of course it needs to be simple and usable, but beyond that, it needs a high degree of craft in dealing with all the kind of processes on the service side of things as well. So, you know, a lot of brands will do a very good job to kind of seduce you to a point where you drop your stuff in the basket. When you go to checkout, it all starts to become quite generic. It's very kind of cumbersome. The checkout process might be multiple pages. You know, the error checking and all those things is a bit clunky, and it's, you know, the spell of luxury is very, very quickly broken. So what we've done, and the, you know, where we've really had a kind of open brief and a very blank canvas, is using a platform called Hybris, which is very open, a kind of technical platform for delivering complex e-commerce. We're able to completely redefine the way that works. So all the checkout takes place on one page. It's very dynamic. All the error checking is in line. So if you make errors, it gets caught along the way, you know, real time, rather than kind of submitting. Then the page comes back with the, you know, the red kind of error, and then you have to correct it. Then you submit it again, then another error might emerge. It all happens in line. And it feels like, you know, why would you spend so much time resolving that stuff? And the answer is really simple, which is you go into any luxury boutique, they will control every element of the process really mindfully because they understand the customer really, they demand that from luxury brands. They're not just... It's not just the item that's luxury, it's the whole
experience. Yeah.
And you know, if you drop the ball at any point in that experience, it breaks the spell. And
the veil is broken, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, and that has an impact on loyalty. You know, it's obviously doesn't help kind of advocacy and those other secondary things. So we just felt like we just have to do, you know, that's what luxury really is. You know, because it was Mulberry, it was really obvious to them why that stuff was important, and it kind of gave us, you know, the support we needed to really work that stuff through, because it's not cheap.
Nicholas Roop of Poke talking to me there. And now we're going to stop off in Madrid, where esteemed jewellery and homewares designer Elena Rona welcomed us into her studio. Nestled in the historic La Latina district in Madrid's very busy city centre, the studio is part workshop, part retail space.
It's a concept which Rona has championed as a means to break down the barriers between the manufacturing process and the shop floor, bringing a level of transparency and informed appreciation to her work. On a very hot summer's day, she took a short break to tell us about what her studio means to her.
I'm a designer, basically a jewelry designer, but I also produce objects for the home, meaning lamps, ceramics, teapots and cups and vases. We also design for other companies, so we have some products in stainless steel for George Jensen and in sustainable wood for Munio, and we do some carpets for Bolia, so we kind of do all kinds of things. When we moved to the studio, I was looking for a place to be open to the direct client. So in our business, what happens is one designs, one produces, one shows it, but one sells it mainly to shops who then sell to their clients. So you never have the direct contact. And I wanted the people to come and see the jewelry and the objects and also to see how they were being made. So I found this place, which used to be a detective's office. And we threw down the walls and we made an open space so that everything is connected. I love wood, so there's a lot of wood in my studio, and I always think it's very warm to have it, you know, to decorate with wood. I have plants, I have essential oils, it's kind of a tick, I need good smells. I have pretty things around me and things that remind me of other things, and color. I think I like color a lot, and color is very present. I mean, I think when you're a designer, you almost, you know, work more with the spaces in the objects than the objects themselves. In the sense, you're looking for the emptiness, no, the void in the pieces. I always decorate at home too. I move things around all the time. So for me, it's very important to be able to change paintings around, ceramics around, and changing the mood. And in fact, if you come here in 6 months, it looks slightly different because the colors will be different and the think board will be different and the flowers will be different. So for me, that's very important that there's movement, I guess, and change all the time. So what's good about summer in Spain, or at least in the studio, is that we have summer timetable, that we call it. And that means you work from 8 to 3. And then the afternoons, you get the time to do famous siesta, which everyone thinks we do all year round, but we don't. Yeah, and to kind of wander the city in July. Madrid is really calm. So there's a lot of exhibitions, there's a lot of concerts to go to. I like music. I went not too long ago to a concert by Joanna, the policewoman, who's a New York, what would I say? She's a very powerful woman, and she's got a song called Real Life, which I think is very appropriate right now.
And it's true what they say about love. Yes, it's true what they say about life, and I'm taking it for all.
That was Real Life by Joan as Policewoman, rounding off our studio visit in Madrid. Still to come in part two, we work out how we can work out whilst at our desks with Vancouver industrial design graduate Daryl Agwin. We look to the future to take a tour of the Industrial Revolution exhibition at London's Design Museum, and we meet two of the emerging architects, Maria Langarita and Victor Navarro, who worked on the sprawling 4,700 square meter music academy in Madrid's El Matadero neighbourhood. This is Section D with me, Alad John, here on Monocle 24. The evolution of manufacturing techniques has sped along in recent years, especially in the ways that they are engaging consumers and involving users in the development of products. How we manufacture, fund, distribute, and buy everything from cars to sunglasses is progressing fast. Emerging technologies and platforms such as crowdfunding, social networking, digital looms, 3D printing, and nanotechnology, to name but a few, of all removing the barriers of access to manufacturing. A new exhibition at London's Design Museum presents these nascent technologies and gives us an insight into what they mean for tomorrow's world. It's called The Future is Here, A New Industrial Revolution, and displays how these technologies are already in use whilst at the same time giving insight into their potential for the future. Monocle's Annabelle Bly went down to Shad Thames to find out more.
I'm Dejan Sujic, director of the Design Museum. This is probably the year that what were subjects familiar to the nerds escaped out of the laboratory in the back room and into public consciousness. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen Maplin produce for sale the first less than £800 3D printer. The Sun put an image of what was claimed to be the first home-printed firearm a few months ago. So we've really been thinking about these issues for a while. We've been thinking about what's already here, things that are not far distant technologies, but existing ones. What's the impact that that's going to have? And try to assemble it in a way which is accessible, which tries to show what new materials, new sourcing methods, new means of distribution, new techniques are going to do not just to designers, but to the world around us.
Yeah, so I guess the exhibition is prefixed on this idea of a new industrial revolution. Perhaps you could tell me a little bit more about what that actually means to the everyday consumer as well as manufacturing and designers as well.
150 years ago, some apparently random technological innovations, the steam engine, railways, textile mills, transformed the world. All sorts of unexpected consequences were the product of that. The shape of cities everywhere was transformed. 60 years ago, a very low-tech thing called the sea container had another impact almost as violent. It allowed globalization, manufacturing in China. The shipping container, this metal box, suddenly transformed the landscape of cities around the world. It meant the end of city center docks, for example. We're now on the edge of something which could have equally profound consequences. The idea that you don't need to invest in a factory anymore, that you can actually make things at home. It's saying that the design process is going to be quite different. And people's relationships with their objects is also going to be completely different. They can be in control of them. We've gone from that model of investing a lot of money in machinery so you can make lots of things cheaply to a moment when you don't actually have to make a very complicated machine to make some simple things. And that's gathering pace. And we're just trying to explore what that really means for us all.
My name's Alex Newson. I'm the curator of The Future is Here, A New Industrial Revolution at the Design Museum in London.
Perhaps you could tell me a bit about how you sort of brought all the core ideas of this new industrial revolution together into an exhibition itself.
Well, I think there's quite a lot of complex ideas in here, and that was one of the things that worried us to start with. We're trying to communicate things that can be quite complicated and technological to a general audience in many ways. You can't pick up the paper or turn on the radio without hearing someone talk about 3D printing, but I think people still don't really know what it is. So one of the key things that we did is have a section right at the beginning of the exhibition that demystifies all of these technologies. So we have a section explaining each of the key technologies, such as 3D printing, such as computer-aided design, such as digital knitting and weaving, and something called CNC, which is computer numerically controlled, which is essentially plugging a computer into a manufacturing machine. So we take those different technologies apart. So we explain them to the visitor, we show what they can do, have examples of what they can do, and we talk to people who use them and get them to have an interview and a video interview to explain them. And then in a way, visitors then have the vocabulary that they need to understand the rest of the exhibition.
Yeah, I mean, the exhibition is fantastically interactive, and there's even a design factory at the start. Could you tell me how that sort of fits in?
Well, I think early on we realised that things have to be active. If you have an exhibition about making things, without things being made, you've kind of stumbled at the first hurdle in a way. However, that's very hard, because making things for a three-month, four-month exhibition is very difficult. You can do it for a one-off day, an hour here and there, but it's quite tough to do for 4 months in a row. So we came up with the idea of actually testing out the theory that you hear people talking about the barriers to access being lowered and everyone can now become a digital designer maker. Well, we thought, well, is that true? Is that just something that people say, or how accurate actually is it? So we've got six of our front of house staff that we've had trained in how to use the equipment. I say trained, they've had 2 days training, so it's very limited training, and they've had no experience in digital making or manufacturing before, and we've let them loose using these digital desktop manufacturing machines to see what they can create. And I think their failures are going to be just as important as their successes, and we want them to engage with the audience to talk about what they're doing, to explain the processes, to talk about their struggles, talk about the things they're pleased with, and I think that all adds to the experience for the visitors as well.
My name is David Bott. I'm the Director of Innovation Programmes at the Technology Strategy Board, the UK's innovation agency. So we've been working with the design community a bit. The Technology Strategy Board is 6 years old, six and a couple of weeks now. But about 2 years ago, we saw a talk by Dan Sujic, the chief executive of the Design Museum, on the original Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, and how, because you were going from making tens of things to hundreds of thousands of things, you had to get the design right, else they wouldn't sell. So effectively, the last Industrial Revolution drove design and technology together. Since then, for a variety of reasons, they've been driven apart. And the, you know, the talk was about some of the factors. But we sat and talked about it afterwards and realized that we had an opportunity to recognize and celebrate those people who did still bring design and technology together and use that as, you know, almost a role model for other people.
Perhaps I could get you to talk me through some of the core developments in the technology that we've been talking about that are on display in the exhibition here at the Design Museum.
Okay, so one of the big things is that we've got here is this additive layer manufacturing, which is a technique that's been around for about 20 years in one form or another. And what it does is it lays down a structure layer by layer. So you can make structures that it's impossible to make by conventional manufacturing. You can make, you know, re-entrant curves and things with holes in the middle that you couldn't make any other way. So, you know, you can't take a block of aluminium and leave a hole in the middle, but with additive layer manufacturing, you can make something with a hole in the middle. So it's giving us a completely different set of mechanical design rules, but also aesthetic design rules. So that's where the customization comes in, because you can make things that look good as well as do the right thing. You can do it for plastics, you can do it for metals, you can do it for ceramics. And the technology has been developing over the last few years. And, you know, as Dan was saying in the introduction, the first sub-£800 3D printing machine is now available at Maplin. It makes plastics, it doesn't make metals or ceramics and such, but it makes something you can have. There's lots of applications where that will really make a difference. It's changing the way the market operates as much as anything.
This is Section D with me, Alad John, on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll be hearing from Madrid's emerging architects, Maria Langarita and Victor Navarro.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Alad John. And now we're off to Spain again to visit a small musical village. With a population of about 60 musicians, artists and technicians, this unique complex of buildings was built in next to no time and lays inside a derelict warehouse that was once a giant slaughterhouse. It is, of course, the award-winning Red Bull Music Academy in Madrid's arts precinct, El Matadero. Young Madrid-based architects Maria Langarita and Victor Navarro have combined temporality, functionality and community across this sprawling 4,700 square meter space. They were recently awarded the Mies van der Rohe Prize for Emerging Architects for their unique take on sustainable design and considered urban planning. Our correspondent Liam Aldous travelled to this indoor musical village to get a feel for the space, meet the residents and to go on a guided tour with the chief architects.
Everything began in 2011. The Red Bull Music Academy was supposed to be held in Tokyo, but after the Fukushima disaster, Red Bull decided to change the place, and Red Bull Spain decided to take it and make it here at Matadero.
We realized we needed to make a project in order to be built in 2 months, nine weeks, and we have to make a project that suits for the academy. But after we needed to make a project that could remove, because this is a temporary project. And we came with this idea that the Red Bull Music Academy in Matadero wasn't going to be a building, but it was going to be a city.
I can imagine the organizers were very concerned about time. So when you suggested that instead of building a building, you were going to build a city, what was their reaction?
They understand very well the strategy. Instead of transforming this 5,000 square meter space into an academy, we shrink the academy into a 2,000 square meters of divided in small volumes. So that gives us a half of the space to work. So they understand it the strategy very well, and it worked.
This academy brings people from all over the world to a place, but them they don't know each other. I mean, they came here alone. And so they need like a space of community. They need to meet with other people and in order to create this music and then record. So they need spaces to get in relation to other people, like being comfortable. So this is why we created a city, because there are plazas, there are spaces where people feel comfortable. Even the garden, this all these plants, it has to do with that, with the idea of being in a place that is not like a working space, but it's more like a city, a place where you feel fine.
We're now in the middle of a mini plaza between these disparate wooden buildings. Tell me a little bit about the space.
Well, we decided to make like this village not only because of the idea of the community, but also because we needed to create like isolation between those spaces. So as we didn't have so much money to make like a specific walls, we separate them. So the idea is that spaces are isolated between them, but not to the outer space. So in the middle of this space, we can hear a lot of mix of music that comes from all the studios. But at the end, from them, they are quite isolated.
For us, it's very important in this academy. It's not only that it looked like a village, but it's also that it came with a very innovative concepts about how using a space, because how you can imagine an academy is a very protected, clean space where you go from one inside place to another through a corridor, inside corridor. But here, you move through the semi-outside spaces.
The Red Bull Music Academy here in Madrid has become home for hundreds of artists and musical groups since it opened in 2011. One of its newest tenants is local musical outfit Majestad, who moved in under a month ago to complete a three-month residency. Pepo Márquez, Alicia Guirao and Jorge Ramos kindly invite us into their studio as they jam the afternoon away.
We're here for a residency, a 3 months residency at Red Bull Music Academy. And we're just in our way to record our first album.
How does the space influence you musically? Because you are kind of in close proximity with each other. You do hear each other practicing. Does it impact on your music?
What we like of being here, I think, is that this kind of sets you apart from your day-to-day activity. We like it coming here because we have a purpose, and we know we have three months to work. And of course, if there are many bands have recorded here, so being here it's very exciting for us.
I was literally blown away. You know, I'm from Madrid, and it made me feel proud of being from here because it reminds me of places of like I've been in Berlin or in London or in Manchester or even in New York. It's great that at last, Madrid can have a facility like this. Although we all know that it's not easy, and we all know that with the state of the economy here, it's tough to manage all this. But it's great that one day you come here and you see people from Sonic Youth recording there, or yesterday guys from Bellrise, or Tortoise playing here, or Shellac playing here. So it's very inspiring, and it's I think it gives the city some sense of internationality.
One of the main challenges faced by Maria and Victor was to build the principal recording studio, and it's here we move next.
This kind of spaces, normally they are built with concrete or similar materials, but as you know, we are in a protected space, so we needed to use something that could be dismantled without damaging the space, this industrial space. So we decided to use these sandbags. They give us the density for the walls and also the cover to give the complete isolation from the outside, and it works really well.
As you can see here through the window, it is like a more than a 1 meter thick wall of sand covering the space. At the beginning, some people, mostly the German people, didn't like it that much because it reminds them to the war or something. But we told them that it wasn't war. It's like it's a bull, black bulls from Spain. You know, this seems like to be in a mountain, in a weird mountain. It's not. We don't have the same feeling here.
One of the most striking features of the complex is the seamless integration of plant life between the buildings. To create this indoor jungle, Maria and Victor collaborated with Mexican landscape artist Jerónimo Agroman.
Everything remains more or less the same, but all the green part is growing with the building.
For the people who come to the first time, they don't expect to have a garden inside a building. So for all the people who come the first time, they say, wow, here they have a jungle like in the middle of Madrid inside a building. No, and this kind of contrast, I think, also gives some value to the place.
Despite being recognized by this year's Mies van der Rohe Awards, the future of Madrid's Red Bull Music Academy currently hangs in the balance. It was always meant to be a temporary installation, but I asked the pair about the prospects of survival for this award-winning indoor musical village.
It can remain, but what it sure is going to remain is the idea of the space. Maybe all the material that we are touching here disappear, but the idea can travel on time and can be rebuilt in the future or be rebuilt in different projects.
For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
You're listening to Section D with me, Alad John, on Monocle 24. Now, we all know we shouldn't sit down all day at our computers, so how about making our workspace double up as a complete exercise station? That's the thinking behind Vancouver industrial design graduate Daryl Agwin, who was calling on his medical background to keep us all moving. Our reporter Lucy Hislop puts him through the paces.
My name is Daryl Agwin, and you just caught me doing burpees on my furniture set, no sweat.
We're joining the industrial designer in his home in Vancouver as he dismantles the desk, chair, and lamp that, rather deceptively, does double duty for a workout routine. Slide out the seat part of the chair, and you have a balance board for your core strength exercises. Pull out two square stands from the side of the desk, and the red stand that supports a computer monitor, and you've created a step. For Agwin, it's about breaking free from the idea that the only way to have a good workout is at the gym on dark grey metallic equipment.
So when I was designing No Sweat, I wanted it to look just as good as a workspace set as well as exercise equipment. And so when someone walks up to it, I don't want it to exude the feelings of typical exercise equipment that you would find in a gym. And so I took a lot of inspiration from the Memphis style movement, used a lot of the geometric forms there and combined them in such a way that it looks like a great furniture set, but also has an alternative use.
Agwin first pursued a career in medicine before segueing into industrial design at Emily Carr University when he moved to Vancouver from his home in Winnipeg. His latest creation stems from his occasional work still as a cardiac technician in the cardiology lab at a local hospital.
So I'm often seeing a lot of equipment that needs improvement on design. Good design can increase efficiency, it can make things safer in the hospital, make things easier to do. And so every time I'm exposed to things that I want to improve on, and so that's sort of what I think about when I'm at work, as well as doing medical procedures. But I'm always thinking about how can this be better, how can I improve it, and how can I apply what I learned in school to create a better product.
The hospital's also where he's seen firsthand the effects of a lack of exercise, with many patients diagnosed with cardiac disease. To help people get physical and avoid what he calls karoshi, the Japanese word for people who die of strokes or heart attacks brought on by overwork or job-related stress, meant No Sweat had to transform from work to workout effortlessly. As he quickly reconfigures a couple of parts, he launches into his fast feet drill. Once he's caught his breath, he explains the workstation's myriad uses.
It's definitely an easy-to-use set. The basis of the set is the exercise step that provides a platform to do a lot of different things, such as bench press, plyometrics, aerobics. And then from there, the set grew to incorporate different pieces, such as a foam roller for rolling out, a weight bar, a skip rope, and a kettlebell. And so all these can be used in combination with each other.
The desk is clean lined with a modern aesthetic that neatly tucks away in his small apartment. Channeling the fun element of exercise, he's used visually stimulating colors and accents of a Keith Haring-esque artwork.
The pattern design found on No Sweat, I actually titled it Curl Bars and Collars. One squiggle, it's reminiscent of a bicep curl bar, and the other figure is the collars that would go on the end of a weight to keep the weight on the bar. I made this pattern in Illustrator and wanted to speak to the Memphis design movement as well as be something very unique.
Now Agwin is hoping for the prototype to be picked up for manufacture, and it is being showcased in the Future Masters exhibit at the IDS West Interior Design Show in Vancouver in late September.
I'd love to see it in production one day if there would be someone who would be interested in developing it, figuring out the manufacturing processes, yeah, getting it out there. But it's quite a large set, so it's quite a big hurdle to take by myself.
However, as I leave him skipping and sweating using the No Sweat equipment, there's little doubt it will keep him fit in the meantime. For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Lucy Hislop.
And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of Section D. Next time, I'll be kickstarting a two-week special on the design scene in Turkey, where amongst other things I'll be speaking to the architects and urban planners who protested against the development of a shopping mall in Istanbul's Gezi Park. We'll also be charting the recent architectural history of the city and tour some of the hidden designer studios and production houses. My thanks to Holly Fisher for her skills in the production den and David Pleasant for his research. You can contact me, Alad John, at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or maybe just bend my ear about an idea you've had. And playing you out this week, here's a favourite of mine from the dustier alcoves of my record collection. This is Jerry Butler with Never Give You Up. Thank you for listening and goodbye. Never.